Hello, Center Church community. Another solo message for you this week in Ecclesiastes. For those of you who messaged me directly expressing outrage that Kate was not on the podcast last week, I assure you she will be back very soon. A few other housekeeping items. Several have approached myself or members of our leadership team requesting, in addition to podcast content for this season that we're in, for some kind of live communication as well. And that's been heard loud and clear. And we're working on doing that and doing it well. And that should be rolling out in the next week or two. Additionally, and finally, because we don't know exactly when shelter in place will end, and even then when it will be wise or safe to gather as a whole church again, we're also working on organizing and facilitating essentially small groups that will be able to function virtually. So there is a timeliness to the message in front of us this week out of Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 8 through 11. And just to orient you, if you have missed a message or two over the last 8 months in Ecclesiastes, this is the second collection of wisdom sayings in the entire book. So there are two collections of wisdom sayings or teachings. The first is in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. The second collection of wisdom statements is in Ecclesiastes chapters 10 and forward. And today we're focusing on a particular wisdom teaching in verses 8 through 11. The central idea is this: human beings have a very wide sphere of control where they are able to shape their lives meaningfully, for better or worse. God has given humanity a wide sphere of control, and we should operate within that sphere with the utmost seriousness, understanding that where we exercise wisdom, it will be a net benefit to ourselves, to our families, and to our communities. And where we exercise foolishness, it will come at cost, not just to ourselves, but to many others around us. So today we're going to be analyzing a particular virtue that will allow us to, in the sphere of control that God has given to humans, that will allow us to act in a way that is wise and therefore generally beneficial to ourselves and to others. Let's read Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 8 through 11. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom helps one succeed. If the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. And I'm sure this could not be more clear. Such is the nature of wisdom teachings. It takes some work to even understand their most basic introductory meanings. Well, that's what we'll be working on in part today. So let's start with verse 8 for a moment. We're going to offer some initial thoughts, some brief exegesis, and then we'll begin to observe how this is really talking about the control that God has given us to shape our lives. So verse 8 says this: he who digs a pit will fall into it. So this is actually chapter 10, and particularly verses 8 through 11. This is actually the source of a lot of literary interest. So we have, whether it's whether it's Tolkien and The Pit of the Dead in Lord of the Rings, or whether it's Lord Byron's poem, All is Vanity, saith the preacher, we get images of these verses. And particularly, there are images associated with the pit. So, he who digs a pit will fall into it. One initial reading of this is, and perhaps it's a valid reading, it's this idea that those who are evil, well, it's this idea that those who are evil will get what's coming to them, that things have a way of working out so that those who commit evil deeds will be the victims of the very evil deeds that they're committing, and that maybe even God is involved in orchestrating this balance. And there's some support for this in Psalm chapter 7. If we take a look at verses 12 through 17, if a man does not repent, God will whet his sword. He has bent and readied his bow. He has prepared for him his deadly weapons, making his arrows fiery shafts. Behold, the wicked man conceives evil and is pregnant with mischief and gives birth to lies. He makes a pit, digging it out, and falls into the hole that he has made. His mischief returns upon his own head, and on his own skull his violence descends. So if that's the pit that's being talked about, then it certainly feels like there's some kind of message about the reciprocal nature of evil actions. Eventually, those people who are trying to trap other people become trapped by their own evil schemes. And that does bring up a really interesting question, which is, do people get what's coming to them? Is this about somebody who is maliciously digging a pit to trap someone who is innocent and they themselves become trapped by it? We're going to leave that alone for a moment because I don't think that that's the correct reading here. Colette is very concerned with, and we touched on this a couple of weeks ago, he's very interested in this kind of practical wisdom. He seems to believe that there are two spheres of wisdom. One sphere of wisdom is this universal wisdom, which only God has access to. And there's this other sphere of wisdom wherein we can control things in our lives, this human wisdom that gives us the ability to navigate our lives in meaningful ways, for better or for worse. And that kind of practical or pragmatic wisdom is often, or at least sometimes, what I think the author is interested in. And actually, I think that's what we're dealing with when we deal with this passage. So one way to read verse 8 is that it is a pit for trapping others. And another way to read verse 8 is that it is a cistern for storing water. Basically, he who digs a pit or he who digs a cistern might fall into it. There is risk to your labor. In fact, and I think the reason that this is maybe a better reading is that it goes on to list three other items, three other labors that don't seem particularly evil to me. And a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. So if you are taking down walls, if you're in construction of some kind, there are risks to that. Or he who quarries stone is hurt by them. Or he who splits logs is endangered by them. These are labors that people have engaged in throughout history, across cultures, digging pits, taking down walls, moving stones, preparing firewood. This is work that people do, labors that we engage in that come with some hazard. We all do work of various kinds that bring about various degrees of hazard. And not always, maybe not even that often, but sometimes hazardous things happen in the work that we do. And I think actually it's brought to a point with this final, almost comical, absurd example. If the serpent bites, verse 11, if the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. So I think this brings up some interesting questions. I mean, first, why wasn't the snake charmer on the ball with this one? He has basically one thing to do, charm the snake before the snake bites you. Or the logger, who has basically one thing to do here, which is make sure your axe is sharpened before you go to work. The better question, though, which I think actually gets more to the point of this passage, is which I think is almost given in through this absurd example, which is, why become a snake charmer at all? I mean, on the one hand, you could say, do it, if you're going to do it really well. The consequences seem high. But is there anything else that you could possibly do other than become a snake charmer? If you can avoid it, don't become a snake charmer. This is, I think, where we arrive at the center of the entire passage, this short wisdom teaching. This is about, this passage is about proclaiming the virtue, the excellence of prudence, and how if we are prudent within the sphere of our control, we can live our lives in much richer and more fulfilling ways, and we can do more good for those around us. So let's explore the value of prudence and how it allows us to shape the sphere of our control in ways that are beneficial. First, this: scrutinize your life and ask the question, are you being prudent? Thomas Hibbs, famous American philosopher, talks about prudence as grasping what is pertinent and assessing what ought to be done in complex circumstances, which I think is very, very insightful. Grasping what is pertinent, what matters and what matters now, and assessing what ought to be done in complex circumstances. Aquinas says that prudence is essentially wisdom concerning human affairs. He argues that wisdom actually is achieved by three things. This kind of prudential wisdom is achieved by three things. He says that counsel is required. Are you inquiring of the right people? Judgment is required. How do you achieve the end you want to achieve? And command is required. Are you willing to apply that counsel and that judgment in a way that is timely? I think we have all been in the position where either we're lacking in good counsel or we're lacking in good judgment. We've received useful insight, but we don't really know how to apply it or employ it. Or we've had good counsel, we've thought it through, but we don't necessarily have the fortitude, have the resources to apply that good decision in a way that is timely. Aquinas, who says that prudence is one of the, and he's not the only one, of course, he's basing his thinking on Plato as well from Plato's Republic, but prudence is essentially seen as a cardinal virtue. All this means is that it's a hinge virtue. It is an essential virtue for other virtues to actually function. And so prudence is actually in the hierarchy placed near the top. This idea that we should work to grasp what is pertinent and to assess what ought to be done in complex circumstances. And this text is all about that kind of prudence. Look, some careers are not worth having. Some loans are not worth taking. Some joys are better put off or withheld altogether. If you're going to chop wood, sharpen the axe. Don't be a snake charmer. But if you are going to be a snake charmer, if you found yourself in the position where you are a snake charmer, then do the work that you need to do in a timely way so that you're not bit by a poisonous snake. And I think that the strangeness of that text, I think, is actually as applicable then as it is now. It's really quite relevant. There are many things that we're spending all kinds of time and frustration trying to navigate. They're complex and they're messy. And sometimes the more prudent, the wiser person actually dismisses of it altogether and walks away from it. Sometimes that is the best path forward. But according to this, I think, incredibly insightful wisdom teaching, this passage in Ecclesiastes 10, but whatever you do, utilize, this is verse 10, whatever you do, use this wisdom to help you succeed. And so in part, Colette is talking about not this hyper-spiritual godly wisdom, but a very kind of on-the-ground wisdom. Whatever you do, become exceptionally good at it. Whatever you do, become exceptionally good at it. Even if you find yourself in the position where you are a snake charmer, this is not an enviable place to be. But even if you're there, become exceptionally good at it. Engage in technical expertise. Develop that. Develop your skills and do all of that in a way that is timely, because that is going to yield much better outcomes for you. This text is incredibly useful on this point. Where has your technical skills and the things that actually matter taken a hit because you're otherwise preoccupied with things that may not even be prudent to pursue at all? Where you're otherwise not willing to act, or you're otherwise stalled on how to orchestrate the thing, which again has to do with what Aquinas defined as judgment. These are a part of practical wisdom, these attributes, these virtues, rather. This is prudence, and it's really understood as a gift from God, but it's a gift from God that we're able to sharpen and refine. Some of us, the technical skills that we need to be pouring our energy into are on the back burner. They're a distant memory because we've not been prudent about the things that we've allowed to dominate our time and to dominate our energy. And I think these practical teachings in this book, it's uncanny how relevant they remain thousands of years later. Use your skills in a timely fashion. Because if we take verse 11 with any seriousness at all, use your skills in a timely fashion, because after the damage has been done, it really can't be undone. If you spent a day in labor with an unsharpened axe, the day is lost. Again, if you're the snake charmer and you're not good at what you do, you're not adept at your work, after the snake bites you, it's too late. The first point again, scrutinize your life. Are you being prudent? Let me define prudence for you again, as Thomas Hibbs defines it: grasping what is pertinent, assessing what ought to be done in complex circumstances. As Aquinas defines it, wisdom concerning human affairs. The second observation from this text that is worth some attention is this. This world is filled with unpredictable reversals. Don't try to anticipate them. Rather, build a life only on what you know to be sound. There is this tendency or preference we give to spending time and energy trying to predict unpredictable outcomes, trying to anticipate absolutely unknowable conclusions. We would be much better to follow what we see in Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and focus on developing wisdom, as Ecclesiastes 10 says, but really what the author means there is a kind of technical excellence. We would be much wiser to spend our energy on technical excellence and becoming exceptional at the things that matter. To do that, to focus in that way, is very countercultural. And it is also a sign of prudence. Karl Barth called Christian ethics the great disturbance because it so violently challenges and interrupts the status quo. And by exercising this kind of prudence and focusing on technical skill, which is a form of wisdom, you are engaging in Christian ethics. You are partaking in the great disturbance because you are resisting the status quo, which, as far as I can tell, is one that is interested in ongoing distraction, be it good or bad. The world is full of unpredictable reversals. Sometimes the snake bites. Don't try to anticipate them. Rather, build a life on what you know to be sound. Use prudence. Exercise counsel. Exercise judgment. Exercise, as Aquinas says, command. So let's summarize. The first observation is this. Scrutinize your life and ask the question, am I being prudent? Am I being prudent? Am I grasping what is pertinent? Am I assessing what ought to be done now in my life? We are living in complex circumstances, in complex times now. Are you grasping what is most pressing, what is right in front of you? Are you assessing what ought to be done? I think that's worth some energy this week. Second, the world is filled with unpredictable reversals. Think about all of the ways we feed into trying to anticipate the reversals that are coming. Better to not try to anticipate them, but rather to build a life on what you know to be sound. This is a supreme Christian ethic, and it requires prudence. Before we wrap up, I want to wind back to verse 8. You might remember that we talked about ways of reading, this idea that the evil person falls into the pit, and maybe that's what verse 8 is actually talking about, as opposed to my preferred reading, which is actually just that people do work that is sometimes hazardous. Let me give you Matthew chapter 5:43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. The Expositor's Bible, in its commentary on this, says that God brings rain to people who need it and light to people who need it, whether they be good or evil, not because God is indifferent, not because God is ignorant, but rather because God is magnanimous to all of his creation. That God is providential to all human beings, irrespective of character. Here's what I take from the Matthew 5 text. The sun shines and the rain nourishes the earth because God is that loving. Notice that in Matthew 5, it uses the word for. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on evil and on good. Our role is to love people in such a way that we abolish the idea of enemy itself. And what we're told is to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us so that we may be sons of our Father who is in heaven. And then it says, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. In other words, his character, his nature should be reflected through our character and nature. That is his character and nature, a God who is providential in that way, a God, as far as I can see, who seems indiscriminately providential or magnanimous. So as it pertains to Ecclesiastes chapter 10, Because, of course, two things can be true at once. God can be generous to the good and to the evil, and it can be true that when people engage in evil and nefarious schemes, it comes back to get them. However, I think the role of the follower of Jesus should be to humbly avoid predicting what motivates the creator of the universe to bring good and ill on people, and rather follow Jesus in extending love and prayer for those who are in our lives and for those whom we never know, because that is in fact the role of the Christian, to love so deeply and so thoroughly that the very category of enemy dissolves. As always, I'm glad to speak with you over these texts, and I eagerly look forward to the time when we'll all come back together and meet face to face. Blessings, and have a wonderful week.